Good morning and welcome to the Arab Spring, a year that changed the world. My name is Ned Roche, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing the session and our speaker. So the session is Palestine and the Arab Spring, and our speaker is Nora Barrows Friedman, who is a recipient of a Lifetime of Media Freedom Award from the Media Freedom Foundation and Project Censored, and was named a top 20 global media figure by Pulse Media. From 2003 to 2010, Nora's work was featured on the daily investigative news magazine Flashpoints on KPFA Pacifica Radio, where she was senior producer and co-host. Currently, she's a staff editor and correspondent for the Electronic Intifada in the U.S., Al Jazeera English, Truthout.org, and the Europe-based Interpress Service. Her work's been featured in Left Turn Magazine, Counterpunch, Common Dreams, and Censored, a yearly anthology of the news stories you probably don't hear in the corporate media. She's worked closely with the Ibda Cultural Center in the Dehesha refugee camp, occupied Palestine, since 2005 as a part of their media administration. Nora has trained dozens of youth in digital media arts, including radio production, engineering and recording, photography, and field journalism. Nora is also working in collaboration with Youth Radio, a national award-winning youth-oriented media training and production organization headquartered in Oakland. I ask you to give a warm welcome to Nora.
Thank you. Does this need, should I move a little bit for this? Okay. So I did have a PowerPoint presentation, but there's been like a mix up with the AV stuff, so I will just be talking. Can you hear me better?
That doesn't.
That's okay. That's just for the camera. So I will project like a Shakespearean actor. So I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the history of Palestinian uprisings over the last 65 years, and how this notion of an Arab Spring is not new for Palestine and for Palestinians. But to kind of get into how and in what context the so-called Arab Spring is kind of working out in Palestine and in the diaspora. So, since the inception of the State of Israel in 1948, when 800,000 indigenous Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their land, there has always been popular revolt in one form or another by Palestinians. And, a lot of the inspiration that we saw in the last year from Egypt to Tunisia and to Syria and everywhere that we're looking at now, a lot of that inspiration was from, popular Palestinian uprisings over the years. So the first Intifada in the mid-80s, especially, you look at the pictures of the first Intifada with the kids throwing stones and people having mass sit-ins and general strikes, and it looks a lot like the photographs that we're seeing today across the region. The first Intifada was defined by popular protest, and to be sure, harsh Israeli countermeasures, including the infamous order by then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, the Break the Bones policy, where people who were protesting in, a so-called nonviolent way, doing these sit-ins, these civil disobedience actions, were met with extreme brutality. The former political prisoner and political activist with Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq, Ziad Hamidan, characterizes the time of the first Intifada as, quote, "It was a unique example of popular struggle involving old and young generations, people from every social and cultural strata, and of every political background. It was a joint struggle of students, workers, peasants, men and women as equal actors. The key role women had in the resistance has to be stressed, to scream for their freedom and their rights. Peaceful mass demonstrations, raising the Palestinian flag, throwing stones and Molotov cocktails, organizing strikes of private businesses and labor forces, even in historical Palestine, and the development of an economy of resistance were the major tools of the first Intifada." So we can even see that not only in the way that the uprisings across the Arab world are acting out right now, we see all of these factors, but we also see what's happening in the so-called Occupy movements around the U.S., where people are being met, you know, with by you know, when they're doing sit-ins or protests, they're being met with extreme police brutality. So I thought that was pretty interesting to remember. After the First Intifada, of course, came the promises of the Oslo Accords and what many have categorized as wholesale concessions by the Palestinian leadership that we still see now, 15 years later, forced by Israel and the Americans to put the decades-long struggle for inalienable rights on the back burner, including the right of return for refugees, of course, while Israel was now free to declare that it had finally a partner for peace. So the Oslo Accords kind of put a damper on the First Intifada. You know, the whole world, well, maybe the West, actually just the West, believed that this was now a step for Palestinians and Israelis to come together. There's that famous handshake on the White House lawn, of course. Meanwhile, Israel took this opportunity to say, okay, look, we've done our work. Now we're going to just steal the rest of your land. So after Oslo came an explosion of settlement building, of destruction of homes, of a concentration of military occupations inside the West Bank and Gaza Strip. We saw the settlement industry expand at a rapid pace. We saw more transfers of Israeli settlers into the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Settlements actually... 42% of the total land in the West Bank were now occupied by settlements right after Oslo. So it actually doubled during the Oslo years. Now it's over 500,000 civilians transferred into occupied territory, which is, of course, against international law, UN conventions. It is illegal for an occupier state to transfer its civilians into the occupied territory. And the settlements are growing, of course, as we see almost every week now, even in like the New York Times. You can see all of these articles about how the Israeli government is still building these massive settlement blocks, how settlement construction is you know, not being deterred by any, you know, finger wagging from Hillary Clinton at all. But you know, Palestinians are getting squeezed from the West Bank and Gaza and inside the state of Israel itself, of course. So an increase in home demolitions. The Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions estimates that at least 24,813 houses have been demolished in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza since 1967. And this is just going apace. Right, you know, in the last few months, actually, more home demolitions than ever have been maybe in the last 10 years, have been recorded in occupied East Jerusalem, where on a nearly daily basis, Palestinian homes and livestock sheds and businesses are being demolished by Israeli bulldozers with impunity. So after this kind of period of post-Oslo trauma that was happening under the auspices of, you know, peace settlements and peace agreements and all these things that were completely antithetical to actual peace, the Second Intifada came about at the end of 2000. And my colleague John Elmer reported in Al Jazeera English in writing about the beginning of the Second Intifada, quote, "As the intensity of the demonstrations increased, so too did international and human rights groups' condemnation of Israel's violent attempts to suppress what was quickly becoming an uprising. Amos Melka, the head of Israeli military intelligence at the time, said that Israeli forces fired more than 1,300,000 bullets in the territories in the first month alone. He said, quote, "This is a strategic figure that says that our soldiers are shooting and shooting and shooting," he said, about what amounted to some 40,000 rounds a day. "The significance is that we are determining the height of the flames. By the end of the year," this is at the end of 2000, "at least 275 Palestinians had been killed and thousands had been wounded, along with 19 members of the Israeli security forces and 5 Israeli civilians, according to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. Palestinian stone throwers were met with Israeli snipers, gunmen with helicopter gunships and tanks. What began as a popular protest movement quickly began to look like a war. Quote, "When the soldiers began to fire on the crowds, people knew that their role was finished and participation quickly declined. It was a war," said Kamal Jaber, a member of the political wing of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in an interview in 2003. Demonstrations were being met with overwhelming force by Israel, and it made popular protest impossible. In February 2001, the Israeli public backed the strategy when General Ariel Sharon, the butcher of Lebanon, was elected prime minister. And then by April 2002, about a year later, Israel invaded the West Bank in a massive operation called Operation Defensive Shield, and reoccupied many Palestinian cities and towns and villages and refugee camps in the largest military offensive in the Palestinian territories since 1967. According to a report by the UN General Secretary General, 500 Palestinians were killed and more than 6,000 were arrested during the campaign. In what is perhaps the defining moment of the Intifada in the Jenin refugee camp, Palestinian fighters held off the Israeli offensive of more than 1,000 soldiers during several days of fierce fighting. Unable to effectively enter the camp with ground troops, Israel responded by bombing the camp with helicopters and warplanes, shelling it with tanks, and ultimately bulldozing a massive section of the camp, leaving 4,000 homeless, according to Human Rights Watch. In 10 days, 52 Palestinians and 23 Israeli soldiers were killed in what became known as the Battle of Jenin. After 4 years of the Intifada, at least nearly 3,000 Palestinians had been killed and tens of thousands injured. Israel destroyed more than 3,700 Palestinian homes and placed more than 7,300 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, according to B'Tselem. And so what Israel was really doing, I think, and according to many people who have studied this very closely, was that they were really trying to cut off the heads of resistance. Not only were they arresting and killing senior leaders of resistance forces and political factions, but they were massively rounding up political activists, students, youth, and putting them in administrative detention without charge or putting them just in prison, where many of them are still today. And then what happened in 2006? In 2006 was the Palestinian elections, most free and fair elections that the Middle East has seen in decades, of course. And what happened? Who got elected? Does anybody remember? Hamas got elected against, of course, the wishes of the West and the Israelis and, of course, the Fatah party, who was enjoying a lot of camaraderie, shall we say, with the West and the Israelis. And then what happened after that? There was a massive collective punishment inflicted against not only the elected legislative council members of the Hamas party, who were rounded up and put into jail, but then, of course, this was just after the Gaza Strip was freed of settlers. And immediately after that, the Gaza Strip was put under siege as collective punishment for exercising their free and fair right to democratic elections. And now what we see in Gaza, of course, U.S. and Israel has put so much pressure on Palestinians there. There's over 1.5 million people imprisoned in Gaza, deprived of basic needs, deprived of medicines, deprived of freedom of movement, basically to teach Palestinians a lesson. You either vote for the people that we want you to vote for, or you will be met with brute force. And, of course, what happened 2 years later in 2008, the end of 2008, was Operation Cast Lead, who I'm sure many of you know about. It was the three-week offensive by the Israeli military on the people of Gaza who were entrapped. They couldn't leave Gaza Strip. Nearly 1,400 people were killed, including more than 300 children. Tens of thousands of homes were demolished. We saw, of course, impressive picture of what white phosphorus looks like when it's raining down on people's heads. People that I talked to during that time said that they thought that they were being treated like lab rats, that this was now kind of a laboratory testing ground for these fancy new weapons that the West had developed and then sold or given to Israel, including white phosphorus, including this horrible new weapon called DIME, dense inert metal explosives that are completely anti-personnel. They are meant to rip flesh from the inside out. People were coming into Gaza's hospitals at the time, which were already depleted from medicine and basic surgical equipment and anesthesia because of the Israeli siege of 2006 and 2007. They were coming in with these injuries that no one could explain, no one knew how to treat. And we still see the effects now. Then a year later in 2010 and last year in 2011, Palestinians were once again pushed to the brink. House demolitions and forced evictions were rising substantially, as well as attacks by armed groups of settlers backed by the Israeli military, as settlements continued to expand quickly despite the tacit and impotent complaints by the Obama administration, which has continued to fund Israel's project of ethnic cleansing and colonization to the tune of several billion dollars a year. Of course, Obama continued the Bush-era package. It was a 10-year, $30 billion package over and above what the U.S. already gives to Israel in order to further do research and development on military equipment. They are working with the U.S. Air Force in developing these new weapons technologies and the Iron Dome missile defense shield system. So Israel gets another $30 billion over a 10-year period, and Obama just signed that contract to continue that, one of his first acts of office. In 2011, a record year of displacement, a total of 622 Palestinian structures were demolished by Israeli authorities, of which 36%, or 222, were family homes, and the remainder were livelihood-related, including water storage and agricultural structures, resulting in almost 1,100 people displaced, almost double the number for 2010. This is from statistics from the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions. So facing these amped-up aggressions, facing so many decades of not only the West and Israel, of course, not giving Palestinians their basic human rights, but also a leadership within the Palestinian Authority, which was becoming increasingly repressive and increasingly collusive with the West and with Israel, not just, you know, in terms of, political agreements, but real collaboration in which since 2005, I guess it was, we hear of General Keith Dayton. Have you heard of this guy? He's a U.S. military trainer who has trained Palestinian security services, Palestinian Authority security services in Jordan, how to specifically, and as Dayton said, how to suppress a Hamas uprising in the West Bank. So he's training these PA forces how to crack down on opposition groups within Palestinian society itself, especially in the West Bank. They're like, okay, Gaza's kind of a lost cause, but at least our friends in the West Bank will have support, and they will be able to collaborate with the occupiers, and the U.S. will fund that transaction. And actually, when I was there a couple years ago, I got a call in the middle of the night because some friends of mine in Dehesha, which since the 1970s was kind of a stronghold for people within the Palestinian, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the kind of communist Marxist secular group, were woken up by jeeps driving into the camp and gunshots being fired and people invading houses kind of in the front lines of the camp. And so people naturally, because this happens frequently inside Dehesha and all other refugee camps in the West Bank, people thought it was the Israeli military. So they came out and they started throwing stones. They realized that it was actually Palestinian security services, many of whom actually had family living in the camp. But they were trained by Keith Dayton. They were given weapons and financial security by the Palestinian Authority, which was financially bolstered by the United States, to go in there and suppress any sort of opposition. And of course, also the Palestinian Security Services has been instrumental in arresting and jailing members of Hamas in the West Bank.
What was the name of the trainer again?
General Keith Dayton. D-A-Y-T-O-N. He just finished his tenure. Now there's this new general, I think Mike Mueller, I think is his name, M-O-E-L-L-E-R, who was a United States Marine guy for many, many years. So that's still happening. So facing all of these, internal and external pressures, we have, the internal repression meted out by the Palestinian Authority. We have the external Israeli soldiers and the Israeli government repressing in different ways from the outside. We have the West coming in and financing all of these horrifying repressive transactions. So facing what was happening and also amped up. I wouldn't say necessarily inspired, but I think kind of bolstered and backed by what was happening in North Africa at the time. Palestinian youth organized the March 15th protests last year. But well before that, actually Noura Erekat, a good friend of mine wrote in Al Jazeera English, well before the call for the March 15th Day of Action. And the March 15th Day of Action was supposedly to call for national unity between the political parties in Palestine, to say, look, obviously the Palestinian Authority is not representing us. Hamas may not be representing us either. PFLP is nowhere to be found. All of these independent political groups are not representing the people's wishes. Our demands are very simple. And it was the youth who organized these. But Noura says, well before the call for the March 15th Day of Action, Palestinian youth, inspired by revolutionary protests in North Africa, had begun to organize themselves in the global diaspora. In late January, Palestinian students in the UK staged a sit-in in the Palestinian embassy in London and demanded that they, along with all Palestinians wherever they live, quote, in the homeland, in the shitat, which is exile, in the prisons and in the camps of refuge, be included in an election of resuscitated Palestinian National Council, the PNC. The students deliberately organized themselves as the General Union of Palestinian Students, GUPS, in order to evoke a bygone era of national cohesiveness and, more importantly, perhaps, transnational membership in a representative body. According to Rafif Ziada, a doctoral candidate and one of the leading organizers of the UK action, quote, where in the past Palestinian students would belong to Palestinian political factions and organize within the structures of the General Union of Palestinian Students, these structures are nothing but empty shells today. That is why when we did hold the sit-in at the Palestinian embassy in the UK, we insisted on using the name GUPS to take back those institutions meant to represent us. Ziada explains that the protesters' demands for the inclusion of a global Palestinian national body in an accountable PNC reflects an inevitable moment catalyzed by the revelation of the Palestine Papers, which were, of course, the WikiLeaks, kind of like the WikiLeaks. It wasn't WikiLeaks, but it was a collection of internal memos from the Palestinian Authority meetings with Western and Israeli leaders that were leaked to Al Jazeera about a year ago. The revelation of the Palestine Papers, coupled with the revolutionary fervor of an Arab Spring. She comments that for several years, Palestinian activists in diaspora had, quote, been wondering what our role is in Palestinian politics beyond solidarity actions. So something was brewing, especially within the student movement, which is, of course, what was happening elsewhere in North Africa and the rest of the Middle East. There was direct action on the ground as well. The March 15 protests for national unity drew thousands of young Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza into the streets. The goal, as Safa Judah commented for us at the Electronic Intifada, was, quote, a mass mobilization of Palestinians to pressure the Hamas-run government in Gaza and the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority in the West Bank to end the four-year-long division. But rather than topple the governments, as was the goal with the uprisings in neighboring countries, demonstrators hoped to be able to bring them together. It kind of ended with a fizzle, of course. Both Hamas and Fatah, as the leading Palestinian political parties, gave these kind of very effusive speeches about how it is the youth that are leading the country, and thank you, and yes, we will do our best to bring ourselves together. But that really hasn't happened. Then 2 months later, on Nakba Day, which is the commemoration of when Palestinians were turned into refugees and exiled from their homeland as Israel declared itself a state on May 15th, 1948, there was a massive demonstration from the illegally occupied Golan Heights south in southern Syria, by Palestinian refugees who were going to return home. This was their goal. They're like, that's where I used to live. That's where my family still has land, and I'm going to return. And so thousands of Palestinians marched to the border, and Israeli forces, of course, opened fire. One man, Hassan Hijazi, which this is one of my favorite stories of the entire year, who was born in Syria but whose family is originally from Yaffa, which is south of Tel Aviv, was able to travel all the way from his... He jumped over the fence, and he was able to catch a bus, and he traveled all the way from the occupied Golan Heights down to Yaffa to visit his grandfather and father's house. He was arrested by Israeli police and held in detention, but not before making his nonviolent right of return action public. The Israeli press and mainstream U.S. media had absurdly labeled Hijazi an infiltrator, as well as the other Palestinians who managed to cross into their homeland. The Israeli army released a statement a few days later saying that the events that occurred on Nakba Day are leading the military to, quote, acquire more weapons for riot dispersal in the future. So the Israelis now were like, oh, God, it's the Arab Spring is now coming across the border to us. A couple weeks later, on Naxa Day, which is the commemoration of the occupations of 1967, as protests raged in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, 21 protesters were killed by Israeli bullets during a protest again in the Syrian Golan Heights. At the same time, Lebanese soldiers prevented Palestinian refugees from protesting. Hundreds of Palestinian refugees living in Syria once again reached the border and were met with brute force by the Israeli soldiers. Speaking to the Electronic Intifada, Salman Fakhreddin, a political activist and the public relations officer of Al-Marsad, the Arab Center for Human Rights in the Golan, said that, quote, it is a blood harvest of the Israeli army. I think first they began shooting to kill, and during the afternoon and at the beginning of the night, they began firing tear gas and rubber bullets. It means that the Israeli army yesterday was standing on its head and thinking with its feet. They dealt with the issue in the opposite of a humanitarian way. They decided to kill people in order to frighten them not to continue with this demonstration because they're afraid of the delegitimization of the state of Israel and the Israeli policy in the international community. On the other hand, the demonstration yesterday and the demonstration of Nakba Day on 15th May is trying to develop a culture of nonviolence in the area in the struggle against the Israelis, or what's called the popular resistance. In Israel, they want to stop that because they're afraid it will reach the knowledge of the international community, and the internal Israeli community will join the struggle as a peaceful struggle against colonialism and apartheid in this place of the world. He said, I think the idea was to stop that, and because of that, they chose this way, to kill people first and then to shoot them with tear gas. And as we know from decades and decades of Palestinian uprising, it doesn't matter if you're violent or nonviolent, they will kill you anyway. In the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, Palestinians took to the streets and to the checkpoints demanding their rights. Interpress Service reported that, quote, while the protests throughout many Arab nations are being called a Facebook revolution and are analyzed as movements of the frustrated and internet-savvy youth of oppressed countries, the protests in Palestine are extensions of protests past. The continued call for justice, the end of the Israeli occupation, and the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their land. The latter right, of course, is enshrined in various United Nations resolutions, including UN Resolution 194, passed in the year of the Nakba, Resolution 242, passed in 1967, Resolution 3236, passed in 1974, that stated the inalienable right of the Palestinians to return to their homes and property from which they've been displaced and uprooted, and calls for their return. Since then, of course, we've seen all sorts of interesting and very heartbreaking types of protest. Just last week, the hunger strike of Khader Adnan, I don't know if you were following the story, but he endured 66 days of a hunger strike to protest the terms of his so-called administrative detention, which is a British mandate-era draconian law that allows the Israeli military to round up whoever they please, throw them in detention without charge, without actual arrest, without a trial, without access to lawyers, family, medical care, and they're usually in solitary confinement. Randa Adnan, his wife, wrote in the UK Guardian on Wednesday, administrative detention is a nebulous and vindictive measure used by the occupation against our young men and women. It is one of the cruel legacies of the old British mandate in Palestine. Today, in the absence of any deterrent or condemnation from the international community, Israel uses it with increasing frequency against university students and lecturers, young professionals, and even elected parliamentarians. Some 300 are being held. It is part of an immoral policy used to keep Palestinians in a state of perpetual poverty and underdevelopment. When a military commander issues an order for administrative detention, no evidence is produced. No charges are brought against the victims, and the occupation has no obligation to give reasons for the detention. This is by no means a legal mechanism. It is simply an arbitrary, draconian measure used to inflict psychological and physical harm on its victims. When they are fortunate enough to be brought before a judge, he can detain them for periods of 6 months that can be extended indefinitely. The prisoner's problem is so prevalent today that Palestinians have had to create a special ministry for prisoners' affairs. So as she said, about 310 Palestinian prisoners are being held in administrative detention, including over 20 lawmakers. So as I mentioned before, when Hamas was elected in 2006, there was a sweeping arrest campaign of elected officials, and some of whom are still being held. And now, of course, we see kind of this rise of the international solidarity movement, not the ISM per se, which is an entity unto itself, but like the movement of solidarity that is global. The rise of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, of course, social media outreach. I'm not a big, huge Twitter fan, but I think that it worked really well in bringing attention to what was happening with Khadr Adnan, for example, and what is happening with other Palestinian prisoners and to policies that Israel is implementing on a daily basis. I think that the BDS movement is something that especially students can do fairly easily in their own communities. I'd noticed that Super has put together a BDS campaign trying to urge the New Seasons grocery chain to pull Israeli products from their shelves, which is really encouraging. And how does this kind of fit in with you know what Palestinians are struggling for? What my colleague Ali Abunaima wrote about, you know, what specifically, what does the Palestinian Arab Spring kind of look like? He said a key question is where and how Palestinians can organize. Unlike Egyptians, Tunisians, Syrians, Greeks, or Spaniards, Palestinians are geographically dispersed in a way that precludes or limits the potential of the kinds of mass mobilizations that have occurred elsewhere. And then he quotes policy analyst Jamal Hilal, who does a very good job of summing this up. He says, the distinctiveness of the Palestinian case lies not only in the fact that Palestinians have, throughout their long history of national struggle, undertaken a number of uprisings that we talked about, some of which went on for years. Its distinctiveness also lies in the overlapping of national cause, the cause for democracy and many social issues. The national movement has failed to address this multidimensional reality and allowed the national cause to obscure all other issues. Palestinians live in a number of countries or political fields with differing political, social, legal, and cultural conditions. Therefore, they must manage their activism in each country in a manner that combines their struggle for self-determination and their struggle for other rights in accordance with the conditions of each community in Israel, in the areas controlled by the PA, in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and so on. So Palestinians are, as I said, not only dealing with this collaborationist regime in the Palestinian Authority, who are all too ready to sell out Palestinian rights and sovereignty, and the heritage and the tradition and the rights of those refugees, the 6-7 million refugees in the diaspora, but they're dealing with the daily effects of Israel's occupation, of apartheid policy, of this neoliberalist agenda now that's kind of enveloping the West Bank. I thought it would be a really good idea. I have quoted many people in my presentation, but I thought it would be a really good idea to finish with a quote by Noor Jura, who recently wrote also in the Electronic Intifada. Some have mistakenly condensed their analysis and questioning regarding Palestine and the uprisings by asking when Palestine will join the Arab Spring or when we will see a third Intifada. But asking this question reflects a fundamental misunderstanding with the nature of resistance in Palestinian society and the role of its intifadas in the collective consciousness of most Arabs. First of all, yes, we are undeniably not in what we consider a formal intifada, but resistance in Palestine is not limited to a traditional understanding of intifada. It is a constant state of being and a struggle which goes through phases of organization depending on numerous factors. It is a dynamic evolution based in a long history of community regrouping and redefining the form and language of its resistance. Just as Arabs in the region spent the decades of supposed quiet by building and learning, Palestinians and especially Palestinian youth are regrouping and reconfiguring. If you think resistance in Palestine is dead, you have not been keeping up whatsoever. The days of one single event sparking a mass movement in Palestine have passed. In today's entrenched occupation, weak political leadership, growing dependence on state donors and non-governmental organizations, and general fatigue amongst many Palestinians, the Third Intifada, if termed that, will not look like anything we've seen, and neither will its beginning. We are going to have to retrain our eyes and imagination to recognize the images of the so-called next intifada in Palestine, because it will not ascribe to any nostalgic longing for the image of uprising. Palestinian solidarity protests with the uprisings are only one of a dozen examples. The March 15th Unity Movement, the May 15th Nakba Day actions, the Palestinian Freedom Rides, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, diaspora voter registration for the Palestinian National Council, of a slow but steady re-strategizing and shifting consciousness in youth and activist communities. The Third Intifada might indeed contain many of the characteristics of its first predecessor, but if the diversity and creativity present in the foundation being built today is any indicator, its beginning will take us by surprise, not because it will be sudden, but because it didn't look like a beginning at all. So I wanted to kind of now turn this over to you guys and talk about strategies and action and ways that student movements especially and youth movements are talking about solidarity and are talking about how to support the movements within the so-called Arab Spring and Palestinians wherever they may be working for their inalienable rights. So if people have questions, I mean, it can be Q&A, but I'd also like to kind of turn this into a discussion.
So let me jump in here and just set a few ground rules for the discussion. First of all, thank you, Nora, so much.
Thank you.
I know that you raised a lot of interest, and the questions, I'm sure, will be lively. So here are some ground rules. We'd like this very much to be a discussion among everyone in the room rather than a question for Nora and an answer and another question and an answer. So I may call on 3, 4, 5 people at a time before going back to Nora, and then she can help to sort of weave the threads together. If you have a question or a comment, everyone is encouraged to do either one. Please raise your hand in a moment, not yet. I'll ask you to speak for under 2 minutes. If you go over 2 minutes, I'll ask you to wrap it up. It's not because I'm trying to be rude, but we want to give as many people in this room a chance to speak as possible. So, any questions or comments? And I should say one other thing. If someone has already asked a question, I might go to other people that have not asked questions to give as many people a chance to speak as possible. All right, so Kurt, you'll be first. And then number two, and I'll start. Hold your hands up in the air until I make eye contact with you so I know that, and you know, you'll be asked to speak. Okay, so we have 1, 2, 3. Okay, Kurt, why don't you go ahead?
It's just a kind of factual question. I'm kind of confused about the different organizations, Palestinian organizations, especially the official ones, the Palestinian Authority, mm-hmm. the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the mm-hmm. Palestinian Legislative Council. Mm-hmm. What are active and what is their relationships?
That's a good question, and it's kind of confusing. I mean, under the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, is supposed to be the umbrella group under which all Palestinians, including the ones in the diaspora, belong to inherently. Oslo pretty much obliterated the power of the PLO to be kind of a national unified organizing force, and instead emboldened and constructed kind of this neoliberalist group that was quickly forming, that was headed by the Fatah political faction to be what is now the Palestinian Authority. So this was after Oslo. And the Palestinian Authority, is supposed to be the representative body now of the Palestinian people. The PLO has kind of disintegrated politically. But many, you know, many youth, I think, as I pointed out, are now trying to reshuffle the decks and not give so much power and legitimacy to the officials within the Palestinian Authority, and instead make it more of like what the PLO was supposed to be like from the beginning, which is a highly representative body, which is based on the tenets of rights, especially the right of return, and not be such a collusive force with the Israelis that the Palestinian Authority has turned out to be. Assad, do you have, you're such an expert on these things, is it? Okay.
First of all, what happened to those elected officials, probably even like Mohammed Mosaddegh, that were jailed after they got elected from Hamas? They must be out by now.
Some of them are out. Some of them, as I said, about 24 people are still in jail. These are elected lawmakers. There are a bunch of Hamas officials who have been they're taking sanctuary at the International Committee of the Red Cross in East Jerusalem because the Israeli government is trying to imprison them. And that's been going on for a long time.
They did.
Like, oh, that's right. Yeah. They just keep rearresting people once.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually a good question. How can Israel do anything that they do? How can it be done that they've taken an entire country? How can it be? It's pretty amazing. And the fact that they get away with doing it and they get to paint everything with this broad brush of, for security reasons, we're now going to detain you for no reason, which is against every single international law in the books. They keep getting away with it. Israel literally gets away with murder. And so arresting and detaining and imprisoning and throwing away the key on elected lawmakers is just kind of another day in Palestine, unfortunately.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
First of all, thank you for organizing
this. Speak up, please.
I was thanking them for organizing this event. My comment is about, you mentioned that the West was upset or was against the election of Hamas, and my thought for discussion is, although I think publicly in the media that was the general gist, I would argue that in fact the West wanted that, especially Israel, to divide the Palestinian movement. And in fact, it was Israel that helped support and found Hamas initially to divide the secular national movement of Palestinians at that time. So I think this is part of the plan, and it always been part of the plan, is to help bring another power to divide the Palestinian movement, and of course legitimize the destruction and everything else that they are doing under the guise that Hamas is terrorists, and the same thing they used to say about the PLO.
Absolutely. The one they used to call Arafat, right.
Arafat is
exactly.
So I think it's just another part of their tactics.
Yeah.
The national rights.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the basic tenets of colonialism is to divide and conquer and to shift blame from one, you know, favored party to the other, depending on the, you know, convenience of what Israel and the West is trying to do. I think that actually it did take the U.S. and Israel by surprise that Hamas was elected. They had put so much time and energy into making sure that Fatah was the favored party. But the Palestinians, of course, can see the writing on the wall. They've known what the PA and Fatah party was up to for so long. People were really, I think, protesting, and they used their electoral democratic rights to do so. I think you're right. I think it probably would be a matter of time before, you know, Mahmoud Abbas and Salam Fayyad were like number one terrorists because they didn't go along with one thing maybe that Israel did. I mean, who knows at this point? Right now they're the pets. But things can change in a heartbeat for sure.
Yes, back there.
Campaign
Mm-hmm. And the on campuses of like, yeah. You know, funding student groups or, you know, just putting out sort of like, you know, items that specifically focus just on culture or technology that is advancing in Israel. So my question is, I mean, as a student, I think in many ways the consciousness about this struggle, you know, for the Palestinians has been raised a lot. Generally, but how do we sort of like take a stand and combat this campaign to whitewash all the politics?
Well, I'd ask you that question. How are students here taking a stand? What is there to lose? How easily intimidated are you? I know, you know, the Zionist groups across college campuses in this country are really intimidating. They can be scary, but they're actually losing a lot of legitimacy. Just, you know, in Berkeley where I live, I was just telling Assad this before the talk. There was a group of Zionist students who decided that they needed to delegitimize the Palestine solidarity groups on campus and Muslim Student Union and all of that. So they launched this campaign of, you know, any sort of criticism against Israeli policy, especially by these groups, is automatically anti-Semitic and has no place, and we as Jewish students feel unsafe on campus. So they actually filed a lawsuit against the UC, and they actually lost the lawsuit because they could not prove that there was any sort of rampant anti-Semitism on campus and that any of these groups were promoting a sort of anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish agenda. And we see what's happening. I mean, I've been actually, if you look on Electronic Intifada and punch in my name, you'll see that I've been following these stories of attacks on academic freedom at college campuses around the country, where not only students are being targeted and labeled anti-Semitic, but faculty who are organizing events to show, you know, films and you know, and lead discussions on Israeli policies, or even start a boycott, you know, group, whatever, are also trying. These Zionist groups are trying to run them out of town and off campus, but they're also losing. They're very intimidating. They're very scary. But they know. You know, what's interesting is if they are so convinced that their position is right, then why would they spend so much energy trying to attack people who are offering a different point of view? You know, it's such a kind of nonsensical, illogical defense mechanism, and it really shows how vulnerable they are. You know, if they knew that their position was right and Israel was doing these wonderful things, they, you know, could completely defend 24 hours a day, then they would just be able to kind of sit back and let whoever wanted to talk shit about Israel be able to do that. But since their arguments are completely indefensible, especially after the 2008-2009 attacks on the Gaza Strip, which galvanized the world, which woke people up, I believe, they have been really going on the aggressive attack. They're acting like wounded animals. And I think this is a prime time for students to show that they are not going to cower to the Israel lobby, that they're not going to stop talking about Israeli policy, that the BDS movement really scares the Zionist groups and the Israel lobbies in this country because it is nonviolent. It is completely anti-aggression. It is educational. It's easy to organize. And it's already, you know, it's just taking hold around, not only around the country, but around the world. BDS groups all over the place are having victories. And it is a Palestinian-led movement. So this all scares the lobby groups here. But what, I mean, what about you? What, you know, how intimidating are the lobbies, and are you willing to stand up to that?
Let me take a few comments and questions before we go back, and you know, give her a chance to get some water. Yes.
The U.S. has changed their policies in detaining
Yeah. Absolutely.
And definitely
Yeah, I think the policies are intertwined. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Did you have a question?
Oh. I'm Heidi. I'm with Super, proud member of Super. Nora, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for speaking so articulately about the Palestinian cause. I was going to say, as a student, the thing, anytime you can speak up in a class, we do have a growing movement here on campus of Jewish student union and some other things. And we did a silent protest not too long ago.
Great.
We sat silently, which I found very powerful.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term, scared the crap out of them.
Yep.
So anytime I have a platform to do, I mean, any way I can take an angle on Palestine and use it, the last year or so, I have spoken up in classes, and then people are interested, at least they're asking questions. So if any of your students take class where you think there might be, you know, if you still have electives, take class where you think there might be a way that you kind of bring the dialogue and do a presentation or ask to do something that you, you know, give a talk, whatever you can possibly do. The question I have for you is there a grassroots movement coming out of Palestinian civil society? It would have to be a yes movement, but maybe something that came out of the March 15th protest that you see has any real possibility of some real good traction.
That's a really good question. Yeah, sure.
On the floor before you speak.
I'll hold that one.
Pete?
Yes. In my anthropology class, our final paper is going to be on terror technology and hegemony. And using the recent movements in North Africa and the Middle East, were the Palestinian people part of that movement where social media and terror technology came together? And if so, how were they involved?
Okay.
Jump in now, or you want one more?
Yeah. No, that's good. So ADD, I can only hold like two things in my head. So I'll take Heidi's question first, the March 15th action. I think, like, as I said, it was really, it had a lot of momentum behind it. There was weeks and weeks of preparatory tweets and Facebooking and, you know, already people were kind of in the streets getting ready for the March 15th protest. When it happened, people that I spoke to and people that we interviewed on the Electronic Intifada were optimistic, but also a little bit disappointed by how it really just kind of fizzled. You know, a week later, people had gone back to their regular lives, trying to, you know, wake up and survive another day. And the leaders on, you know, both Fatah and Hamas's leadership really didn't change anything. You know, they might have met once or twice and had a really nice cup of coffee and, you know, said all these great, you know, soundbite clips that the local media could use. But really nothing has happened. There has been, you know, some talk here and there about another kind of resuscitation of this, you know, end the division sort of negotiations between the two parties. But really it doesn't seem like that provided specifically any traction because of the March 15th movement. I was there in March and April of last year, and by the time I left at the end of April, there were still tents, like Occupy tents. I hate that. Sorry, I just got to say, I hate the term Occupy. It just has this horrible connotation. But anyway, despite that, there are still tents in the middle of the, you know, the squares in Bethlehem and Ramallah and about Tel Karim and a lot of all the other places in the West Bank. And I think there's still even a couple of people meandering in one of the squares in Gaza City. But I think by the time summertime came around and nothing was really happening in terms of leadership, it did fizzle. But around that time, of course, was also the Nakba Day protests, the Nexa Day protests, and then kind of, you know, more of these like spontaneous protests against specific actions that were happening in the West Bank, such as like crazy rampant home demolitions, or, you know, Israeli soldiers opening fire in places like Nabi Saleh and killing protesters. I think though that and then to kind of tie in your question, I think the social media aspect has provided some sort of like constant traction. There's like this constant underlying, and it's always been constant in Palestine, as I said. You know, it's now six decades, over six decades of constant traction in terms of popular uprisings. But I think social media has played a part in at least giving Palestinian youth a way to keep it on the front burner. I see a lot of Palestinian youth using Twitter and Facebook. And although people, you know, are very clear that it's, you know, Twitter and Facebook isn't going to save the planet or bring refugees back home, I think that it's a really good tool. And it's also provided ways that that Palestinians, I think, who are entrapped in these, you know, Bantustans and these open-air ghetto prisons can actually reach the outside world and maybe not feel so isolated. And I think that has the power to motivate an internal movement. So, like Noor Jura was saying at the end of my talk, I think, you know, we don't know exactly what will be the spark for the next, you know, huge popular uprising, but something is coming. I think something is. And all of these factors kind of play a part in helping to you know, sum that all up.
Yes.
No behind.
My question is so practical. We've been waiting for the Palestine spring. And the occupation is horrible. I've been there. Cell phones are ubiquitous. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because they own them. Mm-hmm. What, maybe Assad can help us, what other avenues, students, you guys that use cell phones, what other avenues are there to communicate so that the revolution doesn't stop on its tracks?
Should I take another one, or do you want to?
Yeah, let's take another one, and then I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Does Hillary find it despicable? Hillary sleeps very well every night. let me take the no cell phone question, though. I think that's a really good idea. You know, during a time, I think about 6 months ago, there was a power outage in Gaza in terms of cell phones. They called it the Gaza blackout. And Israel said that one of their bulldozers doing some sort of security work on the other side of the boundary inadvertently cut a cable, you know, the cable that apparently fed power to the cell phone tower in Gaza. Nobody thinks that it was a mistake. But there were people who were tweeting from underneath the Gaza blackout who had Blackberries, and for some reason Blackberry Messenger service worked while all other Jewel and Orange and Cellcom and all these other regional cell phone services were out. So I don't know. I mean, people were trying to figure out why Blackberry was working, but not the regular cell phones. It's a good question though. Like, what if, you know, and this has happened many, I mean, even before cell phones, of course, and before Twitter and Facebook, Palestinians were resisting anyway. If a tree falls and no one's there, does it make a sound kind of thing? But they, you know, it was never a deterrent whether or not the world was watching or not. They were still going to resist. And I think anyone under occupation and oppression is still going to resist whether or not they have Twitter or cell phones. I don't know practically what alternative there is at this point. I mean, people are really watching what's happening in Palestine. People are very attuned, especially, as I said, especially since Operation Cast Lead. People have been inspired to take note of what's happening in Palestine. So I think if there is another big Gaza blackout, for example, and there's no information coming there, it will actually serve to galvanize people to, you know, knock on the doors of their elected representatives and say, what the hell is going on in Gaza? We haven't had any communication with anybody there in 3 days. That's my optimistic hope, but I don't know.
Okay, let's take three more. One and two and three. Actually, Maxine was first. So
yep, I've had my hand up every time.
You're next. You're fourth. Let's do four before we go back to Nora. Okay, so Maxine.
Mine's just an announcement that apparently there is a projector, and at lunchtime, something that fits really well in with Nora's wonderful presentation is there's a film. lunch in room 238.
Right.
Cool.
And, so if you're, you know, want to watch that film during lunch, it's great.
Okay, let's go with Clive first, and then two, and then three. Sorry, I apologize for that.
What Bashar Assad is doing to Holmes is almost identical to what Israel did to Gaza during Operation Castle like 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When the world community tried to condemn Israel for that, the United States vetoed it in the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
So when the world tried to condemn Syria for that, China and Russia vetoed that in the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
So here the King gets up and says, that's horrible, you have blood in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
How weird that she looks when she says something.
I don't think she does think she's ridiculous. I think she's continuing the party line that the Democratic Party and the Republicans and anyone else who's been in the White House has always had towards people in the Middle East, where we get to pick and choose which regimes we like, and you know, and nothing else matters. And we look like hypocrites all the time. The entire world knows that we're hypocrites. I mean, you know, with Guantanamo Bay is still open and functioning. When Obama ran on a platform that said he was going to shut it down, the first thing. So, I mean, I don't, like I said, she sleeps really well at night. She doesn't, she has never even feigned concern over the well-being of people under oppression. I mean, if she did, then she would be working at, you know, a halfway house here in Portland. But no, she's the Secretary of State. It is her job to continue the status quo of the U.S. government. And she's doing a really good job. She's doing a really good job. It should. It's very bothersome.
Well, Amy, Nora, I really miss hearing you on Flashpoint.
Oh, thanks.
And, really.
Thanks.
But I wanted to draw attention to, I've been recently reading this one website, which I'm pretty impressed with, Nadia, the Uprooted Palestinian. It's called Uprooted Palestinians. She's out of England.
That's great. I haven't
and,
heard of it.
And she has a pretty impressive blog.
Great.
From a real kind of a true Palestinian perspective, which mm-hmm. is very refreshing. And then also just to alert people to some kind of interesting Israeli dissidents that I've also become aware of. One is this guy named Gilead Atzmon, who now lives in London. As a jazz musician, he's been writing on this whole issue quite a bit. He's just written a book, and he's the Zionists are after him, big time. And he's been writing about what's going on with some clarity. And of course, there's Mordecai Vanunu, who's still sitting in jail, and another guy named Roy Tov, who's now in Bolivia. He wrote this book called Across Bethlehem. Pretty fascinating character as well. T-O-V.
I think there's, I don't know. I have personal issues about Gilead Atzmon. I think there, it's very political. Thank you. Yes, it is. Well, yeah, personal is political. we don't have to go into it now, but I think there's, Gilead Atzmon is actually, you think I should, come on over here, you want to back me up, I think there's a lot of very valuable analysis coming from many Israelis. I you know, instead of Gilead Atzmon's analysis, which I think is kind of flawed and very actually, he's very sexist and racist, and I think his conflation with Zionism and Judaism is actually a big problem. And I don't think that he represents I don't think he represents my political analysis or that the political analysis of many, many people, including Palestinians. I think people like Ilan Pappe. His analysis and his take on what's happening is much more valuable as an Israeli. You know, if you want to listen to Israelis and hear what they have to say, I think Ilan Pappe's research is impeccable. I think his analysis is impeccable. But I think we also should listen more to Palestinians. I think that Israelis have had the floor for 65 years now. And I think that Palestinians deserve the spotlight. There's so many incredible Palestinian thinkers and scholars and youth and bakers and taxi drivers who also deserve just as much, if more, FaceTime than people on the so-called other side of the line. So, I would encourage people, because I'm now going to make a plug for EI, I would encourage people to read The Electronic Intifada. We are one of the few websites, English language websites that feature majority Palestinian voices and analysis. Assad's blog, of course, is also one of my go-to places for analysis from the voice of the people themselves. For history, if you want to read an Israeli writer who has his facts straight, then read Ilan Pappe. He wrote The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which is one of the best books ever written about the history of what actually happened.
Yes.
I'm curious, how many of you here knew what the speaker talked about? How many are familiar with it, with what's going on, that you've heard this situation? Well, that's interesting. I thought that this was not a naive group here. But the question I had is, I know this is going to be stupid, maybe, but what do you think we should do about it? I've been fighting this thing for at least 10 years. When I joined Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, gave them $1,400, and that group folded, and they called for a double state, a recognition of Palestine. And then I joined Jewish Voice for Peace. I think they're very militant. And as a matter of fact, do you know them?
Mm-hmm.
They protested Netanyahu in Texas. And there's another one that's an offshoot, I think, and he's been here, Benami, in Portland for J Street. And I've been to their meetings a couple times. But the question again is, I've written Obama 150 letters at least on this subject. I know you think I'm BS and lying to prove it. What can we do? Maybe everyone here write letters to your congressmen, to your senators, and Bon Amici. I have to learn those new names. I had a hell of a time learning and remembering Wu since I've had a cardiac arrest. So I'm not very articulate. So
I think.
Okay, let me.
Oh, sure.
Did you have a comment, Wyla, before we?
Yeah, sure. I was just going to talk about some of the stuff that's happening globally that people can kind of get plugged into real
sorry.
Quick.
No. Thank you.
Obviously real important, and you're probably going to hear me say this a couple times throughout the conference, so bear with me. But I think, to answer that question, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, I think, is really where the people in the United States can make the largest change. I mean, the reality is you can write your senator or your congressman a letter. Don't hold your breath. We can't even get single-payer health care, which 80% of people in this country support with writing letters. So, the idea that we're going to change policy by doing that, I think do that, but we also have to support that, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. I think for a couple of reasons. One is it's the movement that has support from a wide consensus of all factions of Palestinian society, the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, all the trade unions, the women's organizations, the civil society organizations that actually endorsed the BDS call, all the Palestinian organizations inside of Israel who live as second-class citizens have supported the call for BDS, and so has the Palestinian diaspora and refugee community around the world. So if there's a place that you can look for leadership in terms of, a nod from what the Palestinians want the people of the West to do in terms of solidarity, boycott, estimate, sanctions are really the way to do it. And they also have been really effective. Nora kind of talked about this ridiculous response from Israel and from their allies in the United States. And the main reason is because they're actually frightened to death of
right.
BDS. One of the Israeli think tanks put out a statement called Delegitimizing Israel, stating that BDS after Iran was the number one, you know, the number two threat,
the threat.
To Israel, because it actually shows the world what the real policies of Israel are: racism, segregation, occupation, militarization, and oppression of a people. So that's really something that people should, I think, can really support here, especially considering 80% of the trade of Israel is with the West.
Yep.
Europe and the United States. 50% of that is here in the United States, actually. It's a pretty significant chunk, so we can do some real damage. And locally, there were two, one campaign that was mentioned, the New Seasons campaign. New Seasons carries about 11 to 20 Israeli products there. We have a letter that's at the table in there for the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Coalition that people can sign asking New Seasons to stop carrying those Israeli products. So if everybody could please sign that letter and say, stop carrying those products until Israel follows international law and dismantle its apartheid policies. And then you can buy all the, you know, Israeli couscous that you want.
It's not Israeli couscous.
What Palestinians are doing, what the Students United for Palestinian Rights is doing here locally, which is here, I mean, obviously holding this conference is one of the things that we've done, but there was a mention of the silent sit-in that was done at this movie showing that was whitewashing Israeli crime. So for students that are here on campus, I would really recommend people to actually join Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. The core of us who have led this organization for the past couple of years are graduating. So we really need students to come on board, and we need them to participate. Our next meeting is on Tuesday at 6:30. So please come to that, and you'll be getting an email.
Thank you.
Okay, back there, and then here, and then there, and then I think.
More about the BDS movement. Mostly as an academic person and a researcher focusing on health issues in the Middle East, my question is more about how do we use the BDS movement in academic institutions and as far as getting more of it, the health issues going on, the environmental health crisis going on in Gaza, in Palestine in general, the siege on water, the control of electricity. How do we use BDS to our advantage in academic institutions as far as boycotting? And it's on the internet. It's hard to find information about how to do that. When Desmond Tutu had that letter where, you know, universities were signing on, I'm anxiously looking through the whole list, like who in the United States signed it, and there was only a couple universities that I knew of that were doing it. So I don't hear much about that part, and I think that's a really great tap in resource for professors. So I'd like to hear from anyone.
Let me just get a couple more.
Sure. Okay, I'll keep that here.
In terms of the international...
Just speak louder.
In terms of the international solidarity movement, I wondered what you thought of the aid flotilla movement that has picked up over the last few years, whether you think it has traction. Obviously, it's proven to be quite dangerous.
Yeah.
Or if you or anyone has any predictions over whether any flotilla will eventually have success.
And let's take one more.
My name is William. I've got two questions that I made. One is sort of a mix of some of the comments and questions that have already come, and that's about the PLO, PA, and so forth. There seems to be a political vacuum in a sense, and this was shown also with the UN statehood bid last year. And, of course, the BDS seems to be a major focal point at the moment of where people, grassroots organizations internationally, can really exercise the most power. But I want to know, who should grassroots organizations sort of be looking to take the lead from Palestinians?
Mm.
And the second question is, coming from London, we've heard some stronger language coming from the EU. I mean, Catherine Ashton used to have some fairly sharp words, and that seems to be toned down. But more recently, you know, the EU has been talking about how Israel is really very rapidly closing the two-state solution. Of course, that's an understatement. But we sort of look to what the U.S. politicians are saying and just shake our heads in disbelief that there's just this complete craven support for Israel, when it seems that internationally a lot of other leaders are trying to, Sarkozy, that open microphone comment that went through. So really just sort of comment on that sort of European-US divide and whether you see more countries sort of trying to isolate themselves from Israel diplomatically or not.
I think that probably behind closed doors, a lot of European countries and other countries around the world, except for the U.S., are wary about cozying up to Israel. But I think that diplomatically and politically, you know, they don't want to see, because now Israel has this, like, card that they use. If you have any criticism of us, you are an anti-Semitic, you know, like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and we're going to bomb you. You know, so I don't know. I think that, you know, like all governments, they are deathly afraid of their people and afraid of popular movements within the popular, within the societies. I think that more and more people around the world are standing up against Israeli policies and implementing BDS strategies and having sit-ins in their, you know, in their parliamentary offices. But I don't think that the EU has any interest in actually implementing any sort of real policies against Israeli apartheid in the near future. I think in terms of your question, who should organizations look at to take the lead? It's a good question. I wouldn't ask me. I would ask Palestinian movements. You know, if you go to actually bdsmovement.net, that's kind of like the umbrella organization of the Palestinian-led BDS movement. And there are a bunch of organizations listed on there from inside Palestine. I think that far too often we in the West look at things in terms of a hierarchical structure. So we look for leaders, we look for Gandhis, we look for you know, individuals who are taking the lead and you know, someone who we can follow. But I think that what's really interesting about the Palestinian grassroots movements, the youth movements and the BDS movements is that there are really no individual superstars. It's all pretty much a collective organization structure. And I think that that is really fantastic, and I think that that you know in that collective paradigm needs to be supported.
It certainly is fantastic. It was more of a question of, yeah. Let's say it continues to succeed. BDS continues to succeed.
Yeah.
Who is basically going to be empowered? Like Carmen Abulsi was talking about this disenfranchisement of the broader Palestinian voice through the UN statehood bid.
Mm-hmm.
So again, as people on the ground working for justice and international law, as the BDS does gain momentum, are there any players, are there any, you know, is it going to be the PA, is it going to be the PLO? It's kind of more of a question to see if also if you had any sort of interactions with Ali, whether he had any sort of insights or thoughts on whether there is going to be a body then that takes that momentum forward. Because, you know, what happens if it does start to move that way? Who is going to be that group of Palestinians on the ground that does take it forward?
There has been some discussion on that. Like, I was talking about the Palestinian National Council, which is kind of like a re-energization of the PLO and taking the lead from these Palestinian student movements and you know, really kind of galvanizing their voice and like I said, like having these very simple demands. I think that that is intricately tied with the BDS movement. I think that this all kind of remains to be seen. And I think as outsiders and as people in solidarity, we have to take a step back and watch what happens and support what happens if this is the will of the people. It's kind of up in the air. I mean, I think Palestinian politics has always had this air of, like, we don't really know what's coming next. And I think that these grassroots movements, especially the ones led by youth, are really should surprise us. I think it should, I think I have a lot of optimism about it. We have one more minute, so.
Did you want to comment on the other question?
Oh, right, sorry. The aid flotilla, I think it was a great idea that unfortunately has failed. I think that it was really dangerous. I think that maybe it was okay to do it once or twice, but I think over and over again, 7 or 8 times, I think spent a lot of money, and I'm not sure what it succeeded in trying to do. There was a lot of publicity that it generated, but that kind of faded out, and people got killed. I'm not sure I think that a diversity of tactics is great, and I think, you know, maybe hopefully people are like re-strategizing.
Turkey, at least.
Yeah, well, we'll see what Turkey continues to do. They were very angry for about a year, and now I think their diplomacy is tending to shift. We got to wrap up. Okay, I think that's it. It's 11:30 already. So thank you.
That was great.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.